Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciates you joining us this fine day in America. We're proud Americans. Here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with Dr. Brian Riggs about his book about Medal of Honor recipient Woody Williams, who just died. Then we'll meet Specialist Derek Seifring, who's on a mounted color guard. Then we'll meet Army veteran Ben Sledge as he talks about his book, Where Cowards Go to Die. And of course, we'll conclude with our military history and our self-defense report. It's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Brian Riggs, the last Medal of Honor recipient from World War II. Woody Williams, a Marine, died recently, and of course, will be buried with honors. And Brian has written a book about him. Okay, Brian, you're a historian and a biographer, at least part-time. How did you decide to become a writer?
You know, it started back in 1992. I had finished my first year at Yale University as an undergrad, and I decided to go over to Germany to research my family. I could finally go to the places where they had once lived because the Iron Curtain had fallen in 1989, and I was able to go into the parts of Eastern Germany, especially in Saxony, in Lower Saxony, where they were from. And as I was doing research on this, I found out that many of my ancestors were Jewish, and I had not known that before. And so I started thinking to myself, you know, what would have happened to my family had we remained in Germany? What does it mean to be Jewish? And so that started playing with my imagination. And then also I saw a film at that time called Europa Europa, which was about a Jew who served in the Nazi military. And while I watched this film, I sat next to actually a German veteran who was of Jewish descent. And after the film, we talked about his time in the military, and that launched me on a 10-year study at Yale, and then later on where I did my master's and PhD at Cambridge, that culminated in my PhD called Hitler's Jewish Soldiers and my first book. And so that's how I started becoming a historical writer and getting involved with this topic of World War II. So that's how I got into writing and publishing books, which I've now done soon to be 6 books on World War II. Flamethrower, which documents Woody Williams, who you were just talking about, who died on the 29th of June, the last World War II Medal of Honor recipient. That was my 5th book. And I have a book coming out here in about a year called Japan's Holocaust. So that's been my journey, so to speak, the last 30 years, in short, of how I got into the writing of World War II and how many books I've written.
Okay. Well, your book on Woody Williams is Flamethrower. Well, that somewhat describes what Woody did, at least for part of his tour in the military.
Yes. The flamethrower was a phenomenal weapon. It's been banned from our military under our laws, unfortunately. It should be brought back. It is an incredible weapon. It's a very cumbersome weapon to carry in to battle. And what people don't realize is that on the Battle of Iwo Jima and also the Battle of Okinawa, basically 1/3 of all the Japanese who were killed by being incinerated, either by portable carried flamethrowers or by the Satan tanks, the flamethrower tanks. Because the men that we were fighting, the Japanese on Okinawa and Iwo Jima, they were not on the island, they were in the island. They were like ants, and you couldn't blow them up or shoot them. You had to actually either suffocate them by putting the flame in the tunnels and sucking out the oxygen and or burning them alive. And Woody was a demolition expert, and when he went into battle on the 23rd of February, the battle started on Iwo Jima on the 19th of February, 1945, when he went into battle that day, he used a flamethrower to basically punch through a particular area of the Japanese lines. And what people don't realize is, you know, 4.5 gallons of mixture of high octane aviation fuel and diesel fuel. And it's in, you have 3 tanks on your back. 2 of the tanks are carrying the 4.5 gallons of the fuel. And in the center tank is compressed nitrogen air. You have a wand, which is, you know, delivering the gun, if you will, delivering the flame into the target. And all that together is about 75 to 80 pounds of gear. And then you have your helmet. You carry a sidearm, usually a 45 Colt, a couple of canteens of water. And all told, Woody, this little, you know, farm boy from West Virginia, 5'5", maybe 160 pounds at this time, carries over 100 pounds of gear into battle. And takes out several pillboxes and kills several Japanese. And that's why he eventually would get the Medal of Honor from President Truman. And so that's why I call the book Flamethrower. And I use his life to tell the larger stories of the Battle of Guam and the Battle of Iwo Jima and then the Pacific War. So it is using his life to really tell us the larger historical issues that we're dealing with, but also honoring his heroics and what he did during World War II, and then how he actually got the Medal of Honor. You know, he's one of 82 Marines out of almost 700,000 that received that medal. And only, you know, a little over 30 of them survived the acts that they did in order to get the medal.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're discussing the book Flamethrower, the story about World War II vet Woody Williams. Woody was an amazing guy. Do you know why he even joined the Marines? What was his motivation?
Well, the story that I uncovered that happened is he was enamored by a couple of Marines who had visited his hometown of Quiet Dell and Fairmont, you know, in the area when he was a young teenager. And he saw them in their dress blues and he was really taken with the uniforms. It's very simple why he kind of gravitated to the Marines. He was in the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, run by General MacArthur at the time before the war. And when the war broke out, he eventually left the CCC, went home, was working for a while. And then eventually, from the records I've seen, he was drafted. And when he was drafted, about a year later after the war broke out, he was able to pick the Marines and go into the Marine Corps just because he thought the uniforms were cool. You know, typical teenage boy, you know.
You know, that's typical of all of us, frankly. I would guess if you asked most of the people who joined the military, it's either because their whole family always did this or because it was cool.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, you know, and also I think once he was in the Corps, he really and I'm a Marine officer, you know, and all the other services. I mean, they do a wonderful job of transforming people's lives. But, you know, you join and then you leave. But in the Marine Corps, you become. It's a really transformation of your identity. And so Woody really exemplifies that esprit de corps that the Marine Corps is so proud of. And, you know, I literally went into the archives at the boot camp in San Diego that just opened up. It's only been open for about 10 years. A lot of the files I looked at had never been looked at before. And I talk about how they transform these young men to be amphibious warriors and to build this unique esprit de corps that the Marine Corps is, like I said, is very proud about and is well known for. And so Woody, you know, his expectations to be part of what he felt was the best uniforms, best group of guys and so on was really affirmed through the training and building up that self-esteem that these young men needed if they were going to fight the Japanese and defeat them.
Yes, sir. That kind of preparation is what saved a lot of lives. Ryan, we're about out of time, but I know our listeners are going to be interested. How can our listeners buy a copy of Flamethrower or your other books?
Yeah, if you know people are interested in Hitler's Jewish soldiers, my first book or Flamethrower that I just wrote the last couple of years. It was a 5-year study. I was very blessed to have it endorsed by the 29th and 31st Commandants of the Marine Corps, Al Gray and Charles Krulak, and then also the famous Marine Corps historian, John Hoffman, who wrote Chesty. And so if people are interested in reading this book, they can find information out about that book and my other books on my webpage, and that's brianmarkrigg.com. Brian with a Y like in Yankee, Mark with a K like in Kilo, and then Rigg, R-I-G-G.com. And they can go on Amazon and find Flamethrower on Amazon. It is in three mediums. It's a hardback, Kindle, and then there's an audio version as well. So if people are interested in Flamethrower, that's how they can find out about the book. And then if they want to send me questions, they can go to my website and send me questions, and I'd be happy to have dialogues with them.
Super. Thank you, Dr. Riggs. Thank you for taking time to join us today. And thank you for your efforts to honor and remember our nation's heroes and their efforts. That's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, freedom is not free, Dennis. And, you know, I'm speaking to a kindred spirit here.
Amen, brother. Coming up next on Front Lines of Freedom, we'll meet Army veteran and Mounted Color Guard member, Specialist Derek Seifring. He's stationed at Fort Riley. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. It's time to run hard for a couple of miles. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts, troops. I'll be right back.
Fellow Americans, we need your help. PatriotFoods.com, we are fighting for the American farmer. U.S.-only fruits and vegetables from your soil. Go to patriotfoods.com, use your promo code FREEDOM, and you get 10% off today. support your U.S. farmer. Promo code FREEDOM, 10% off. Thank you so much.
It's great food. I eat it. This is Colonel Danny Gillum, patriotfoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
Nearly 30% of veterans have disabilities caused by military service. At Berry Law, we fight to make sure that every veteran receives full compensation for their injuries. Our team of attorneys, veterans, and former VA employees have helped veterans recover over $100 million in back pay from inadequate VA decisions. For a free consultation, call 888-883-2483.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Specialist Derek Seifring. He's assigned to the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley, Kansas, and he's on the Horse Guard. I joined Berry Law for their celebration on Memorial Day in Omaha, Nebraska, and I ran into Derek and some of his colleagues, so we suckered him in to be a guest on the show. Glad to have you join us, Derek.
Well, thank you, Danny. I really appreciate being here.
So you're a specialist fourth class in the United States Army stationed at Fort Riley. When and why did you join the Army? What was your life like and what led you to even consider the Army? Is that a family tradition or something?
Well, I did have both my grandparents serve both in the Korean War. And I joined in July of 2019. I felt a call to serve. I joined out of high school, so I didn't have much work experience, but I grew up working on my grandparents' dairy farm and a little help around the farm.
Well, that makes sense. The one piece of advice I still remember from my first platoon sergeant as a brand new second lieutenant was always try to get farm boys into the unit. So, because they know how to work, and apparently you know how to work.
Well, certainly my grandpa and my dad never took it easy on me. And it's interesting you bring that up because I also grew up hunting with my grandparents, and they certainly taught me how to shoot as well.
And that probably includes weapons safety.
That, of course, it does. That's the first thing you always learn in handling a firearm.
That's the first thing you should always learn. There are a few that don't, and that's law enforcement's issue sometimes. Anyway, so why did you join the Army? What led you there?
So I felt definitely a call to serve. Growing up in a small town as I did, patriotism and service to the country ran pretty deep. So being surrounded by the great people that I did go to school with, and grandparents and, you know, parents and veterans of all sorts, they kind of led me to take an interest in joining the military.
Okay. Well, but the military is, you count the Space Force, there's whole bunches of them. What led you to Mother Army?
Well, both my grandpas, they served in the Army. But I did certainly explore the other branches before settling on the Army. In my case, suited what I wanted to do in furthering my career and what I wanted to do further on in my life.
Okay. And so what did you become when you enlisted?
So my original MOS is a 94 Foxtrot, a computer detection systems repair. What we would do is fix night vision goggles and other computer systems. But today I work as a supply sergeant for the Commanding General's Mounted Color Guard.
Okay. How'd that transition work?
Well, they were short a slot and I had an interest in working with horses. So when I came down here, they told me I had to learn how to be a supply sergeant.
So you had worked as a computer repair, that you'd done that for a few years, and then you got orders to go to Fort Riley?
Actually, I was fixing computers on Fort Riley.
Okay.
And that's when I found out about this organization and what you could apply, so I did.
And shazam, you suddenly found yourself in the Commanding General's Mounted Color Guard?
Yes, sir.
And what kind of training do you have to go through to do that?
So there's a 60-day candidacy process in which you do bareback, saber training, pistol, firearm, shotgun, and a bunch of saddle time on the back of horses.
I'll bet you enjoyed that.
It was a grueling process. During the 60 days, you don't have a day off. So you get up at 5:30 and do stable duties in the morning, and you do afternoon stable duties. And in between is all of your training.
But there's a finite length to it. It's going to end, and you're learning and getting yourself ready to do something you want to do. There's a difference between that and this junk could go on forever, right?
About day 45, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. That's when they start asking you for your initial issue sizes. So that's when you get issued your dress reds. And when you finally do make the team, get your red hat.
Okay. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Specialist Derek Seifring from the 1st Infantry Division, where he's a horse guy. So you guys are out regularly, either performing, if that's the right word, or demonstrating for the public, which could include other military units, or training for that. Am I right?
That is correct. So currently we are in Omaha for the Memorial Day celebration. But throughout the year, we will go to other celebrations, rodeos, parades, and places to present colors.
And I would take it that you enjoy that, because your approach seems to be you're doing what you want to do with the people you want to do. And that doesn't mean it's all fun and games, but that you're someplace you're glad you are. Am I right?
That is correct. My coworkers make it fun. The job is great. And to be able to say that you're in the United States Army at the same time is phenomenal.
So if someone listening wanted, like being horses, how might they approach that? Do you have any idea how somebody from California or Florida or someplace who was interested in this, how they might pursue it? Do you have any idea?
So this job isn't actually a job that you can enlist into the Army as. You have to first go through basic and your AIT. But you can't join the Army to come to this unit. What you have to do is first join the Army underneath a different MOS and then volunteer at your caisson, platoon, or whatever horse attachment it is at that base.
Okay, probably you need to perform at some level and show some demonstrated good attitude and expertise before they'll even look at you. Is that a safe bet?
There is an interview process in which our first sergeant and commander, as well as our platoon sergeant, will put you through. They want to make sure that you're in it for the right reasons.
So I guess the one thing you could try to do is to enlist for Fort Riley, Kansas.
That is correct. I'm sure if you get to your basic, you could request for Fort Riley to join us.
And requesting it doesn't mean you're going to get it.
No, it does not.
You ask for what you want, you take what you get. And that's how the Army works, and that's probably how it should work. Is this something that you really are fulfilled by? Is this something, I suspect you probably don't see yourself doing this for the rest of your natural life, but in the short term, are you in the right place?
I believe I am. There's no place I would rather be, especially, while in the Army. So there's no better job. So I'm really happy with where I'm at.
And do you, at this point in your life, do you know if you're going to look to stay in the Army for a career, or is that still a possibility, or have you decided you're going to do something else?
So I'm actually in school right now for environmental science, with hopes to become a wildlife biologist in the future. So taking classes online has kept me busy in between traveling, but I look forward to more to come.
That's awesome. Thank you, Derek. Thanks for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your service to our nation now. And as an alumni of the 1st Infantry Division, thank you for being part of the Big Red One.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gillum. I appreciate being on.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with Steve Wilson from helpvet.net. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
HelpVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HelpVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at healthvet.net. Visit healthvet.net for all your family's needs.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or do it on Facebook. It's a pleasure to welcome Army veteran Ben Sledge. He had two tours in the Mideast after 9/11 and saw some really heavy combat, which he struggled to recover from. He did recover and wrote a book. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's an honor.
Ben, start by telling us, when and why did you decide to join the military? Is it a family thing or what?
Well, you know, there's a joke, and I'm sure you've heard it, that military service runs in the blood for those of us that have a long lineage of it. We've actually traced our service back as far as a general under Napoleon, and then it just went from my grandfather's on down to my brother and I. So everyone in our family has just served. And then it also kind of became a way for me to pay for college. And I think a lot of people initially do that.
Well, sure. They do everything for more than one reason. There's the noble one, and there's some other ones too. And frankly, there's wisdom in doing that.
Right.
So sure. Okay, your book, Where Cowards Go to Die. That was a shocking title to me. But when I read the book, it tells your story, and it's an appropriate title. There's really two phases, your time in combat and your time in recovery. That's how I read it. Did I get it right?
I would say that's correct, yes.
Start with us about your time in combat. What'd you do?
So I was in the Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command, and I enlisted as a reservist and ended up spending 4 years on active duty once 9/11 hit. So that was kind of a big joke. But really, I worked a lot with the indigenous local populations, gathering intelligence, minimizing civilian interference on the battlefield. And I like to tell people, you know, because you interacted with the local populace so much, you either made friends or you got shot at a lot. So it was kind of a both end situation for me. And I got to see pretty much the best and worst parts of war, you know, in Afghanistan, building girls' schools and the reconstruction efforts in Ramadi, but then also at the same time going on numerous raids and patrols and obviously combat missions.
And, you know, there's no way you can do that and it just be, oh, well, yeah, I did that. It's not like going to a really cool football game or something like that. It's life-changing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's the part that's really difficult, because when you're in those combat scenarios, it's like playing God. And I write about this in my book that, you know, you have the power to protect life or take it away. And so it becomes this very intense moment. And then you have to kind of reconcile what you did overseas eventually with the person that you become out of that experience.
And that's a simple explanation of a very complicated process.
Yeah.
But what you go through in combat, and there's a thousand different variants of combat, but we're talking about where other people, where you not could be, but were shot at multiple times, and you shot other people multiple times. That's quite a different than I served in uniform, and yeah, there's artillery coming in every once in a while, and I fired my gun twice. There's a huge difference, isn't there?
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, everybody processes things differently. I think for me, it was really the repeated shelling when I was in Afghanistan that I think kind of tortured me beyond the brink of sanity. And what's funny is I would later read E.B. Sledge's With the Old Breed, and he said the same thing. And when you're in those environments day in and day out, it does something to the mind where you develop this gallows humor, you know, this dark humor where you're laughing about death and destruction. But then also at the same time, this weird thing happens where you become comfortable with dying because you've seen so much death and destruction.
Yes. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Army vet and author Ben Sledge about his book, Where Cowards Go to Die. Okay. Combat is combat and it puts pressure on you. Recovery is a much less understood process, and it's so variable because everybody's a bit different. Talk to us about your recovery.
So when I came home, I was very broken, and I'd had some very unfortunate things happen. My wife at the time, she left like 3 months prior to coming home from Iraq. You know, I got home from Afghanistan and I had to deal with this experience that I write about in the book where I'm not sure if we killed a teenager. And so you have that stuff that kind of leaves almost somewhat of a bruise on your soul, and the rest of the world has moved on and the war just kind of became background noise. So I had to discover like, okay, I had a sense of mission, meaning, and purpose when I was overseas, and a camaraderie and brotherhood. I don't have that anymore now that I'm back here in the States, and it feels kind of jarring and alienating. And the safe way out would just be, you know, to just keep living my life, doing whatever I want to do, numb out, you know, drugs or alcohol, whatever it is, what a lot of people tend to do, or I could face those demons and start to get better. And it took a couple interventions and people just really loving me through difficult times for me to begin that process of excavation.
You know, that's right. What your ego wants you to do is suck it up and go on. Mm-hmm. And the old male ego is really good at, and that involves drinking and whatever to hide it. At some point, you've got to tell your ego, sit down, shut up. I'm hurting and I need help. And then you've got to find the people that will help you. And apparently that worked for you.
It did. And I think, you know, at the time, counseling and, you know, mental health was kind of an oxymoron in the military. And I was one of those people who was like, counseling's for, you know, wussies and the whole deal. And the reality of the situation was it takes a lot of courage to say, I'm in a dark spot right now. I don't know how to process what I've been through. And I need other people, the same way you'd rely on a battle buddy, to kind of make it through this trial by fire in my mind. And really, that's where the progress began and started, was talking about those experiences. But even for a real long time, I wasn't able to bring them up until I felt comfortable or safe around the right people.
And that's a huge part of it. And it is true that you're more comfortable talking with somebody who has experience, who knows what you're talking about. And certainly this is unless you've been there and done that, you can't really understand. That's why we need our battle buddies, right?
True. One of the things that I think is really important is for veterans to rely on each other. And I think we did a really good job with that after what happened in Kabul in August of 2021 with just kind of the embarrassing, you know, fallout from the withdrawal. And that was a huge pivotal moment to see us all talking to one another. But also at the same time, you know, I think most of us want to tell our stories, but we're afraid. Well, not even afraid. It's just the way that a lot of the civilian populace reacts when you begin to tell the true war stories that aren't pretty, that don't paint you like a hero. And they kind of recoil. And out of that, we need better understanding from the civilian populace as far as what happens actually in war, which is a big reason why I wrote the book, because I didn't want us to just go on living our lives, enjoying our freedoms, and then going, oh, you know, la-di-da, we were in this war for 20 years and it didn't really cost us anything. And really, they need to understand that cost too. And as they begin to understand, then you'll be able to communicate that more effectively, and they come alongside in that healing process as well.
You know, World War II and before, we didn't go to war unless Congress declared war.
Right.
The last time Congress declared war was World War II. These sort of pop-up kind of fights that I was in, you were in, I've often said the military's at war, the population's at the mall, and Congress is at lunch. I mean, yeah. Our nation didn't go to war. They sent our military off to fight. That's a huge part of this, isn't it?
It's a massive piece. And at the end of the book, this is something that I've really, you know, I try not to be too salty, but I'm salty about it, if I'm honest. It's like we send our young to die on the whims of politicians who've never served in the killing fields. And there's a deep travesty to that, because I think once you've been there and you've seen what happens, you are a lot less likely to go over into armed conflict where you see the collateral damage and your buddies die coming home in those coffins. You're not going to want to send your constituents to that environment because you realize that's the dark underbelly of human nature. And we don't want people to be exposed to that. I love what General MacArthur said. He said, the soldier above all others prays for peace because he alone has borne the deepest wounds and scars of war.
Well said. Ben, we're about out of time. Where can listeners go to buy a copy of Where Cowards Go to Die?
anywhere major books are sold, Amazon, Audible, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, just pick it up. Love your support. I think you'll love it too.
We need all of us. We need to make sure the next generation understands these things.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your service to our nation. And thank you for this great book. I'm proud to call you a friend.
Thank you, brother. It's an honor to be here on the show with you.
Troops, if you're a veteran who's having trouble with your disability, getting it approved by the VA, contact Barry Law. Reach them at PTSDlawyers.com. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag, then it's military history. You've reported for duty to Frontlines of Freedom. Let's do some more push-ups now. Hey, how about 60 this time? I want you Ranger ready, then stand at ease.
$30 trillion in debt, 20 years of endless war, and veterans not able to get the care they deserve. These are some of the issues concerned Veterans for America is confronting head-on. At CVA, we aim to amplify the veteran perspective to create a better future for all Americans. But we need your help. Join CVA in shaping a better tomorrow for you, your family, and your community. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement. That's cv4a.org.
If you are suffering from anxiety, joint muscle aches, or trouble sleeping, try Day 3 Creation, a Christian family-owned provider of American-made, non-intoxicating, non-addictive CBD products created from natural, organic, laboratory-tested ingredients. Day 3 comes from a servant's heart as God calls us to care for each other with compassion and honesty. 10% of all profits go to Patriot Paws, providing disabled vets with service dogs. Visit day3creation.com to learn more. God bless. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Skip, what's the first one?
Well, Navy vet Sam wrote that they're talking about restricting the possession of firearms again. Haven't they realized that criminals don't obey the law? The laws only restrict law-abiding citizens.
Sam, what you said is absolutely true. Too many politicians are only interested in adding to their own power and taking away your rights. Be careful who you vote for in the upcoming election. Skip, you agree with that, don't you?
Oh, hoorah. Definitely, Colonel. People just don't get it.
They don't.
And Marine vet Sheila was never stationed at Camp Lejeune, but she really was glad to hear that totally mismanaged situation is finally going to be dealt with. She knows some people who were really messed up physically by being there.
Sheila, you're right. It's long past due for that to be fully exposed and dealt with. I'm really pleased that Barry Law will be working on that. They do take care of vets. And now it's time for military history. What's first, Skip?
Well, on 18 July 1918, during World War I, 3 days after a German offensive near the Marne River in the Champagne region of France failed, Allied forces launched a major counterattack, ending the Second Battle of the Marne and decisively turning the tide of the war toward an Allied victory. Casualties at the Marne were staggering, with Germany losing 168,000 soldiers to death or injury, compared with 95,000 for the French, 13,000 for the British, and 12,000 for the U.S. After the disaster at the Marne, Ludendorff was forced to call off a planned German offensive further north, in the Flanders region stretching between France and Belgium, which he had envisioned as Germany's best hope of victory. In the end, the Second Battle of the Marne marked the last large-scale German offensive of World War I.
And on 18 July 1925, 7 months after being released from the Landesberg jail, Nazi leader Adolf Hitler published the first volume of his personal manifesto, Mein Kampf. Dictated by Hitler during his 9-month stay in prison, Mein Kampf, or My Struggle, was a bitter and turgid narrative filled with anti-Semitic outpourings, disdain for morality, worship of power, and the blueprints for his plan of Nazi world domination. The autobiographical work soon became the Bible of Germany's Nazi Party. In the early 1920s, the ranks of Hitler's Nazi Party swelled with resentful Germans who sympathized with the party's bitter hatred of Germany's democratic government, leftist politics, and Jews. In November of 1923, the German government resumed the payment of war reparations to Britain and France. The Nazis launched the Beer Party Putsch, their first attempt at seizing the German government by force. Hitler hoped that his nationalist revolution in Bavaria would spread to the dissatisfied German army, which in turn would bring down the government in Berlin. However, the uprising was immediately suppressed, and Hitler was arrested and sentenced to 5 years in prison for high treason. But he came back.
And on July 19th, 1943, during World War II, the U.S. bombed railway yards in Rome in an attempt to break the will of the Italian people to resist, as Hitler lectured their leader, Benito Mussolini, on how to prosecute the war further. On July 16, President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill appealed to the Italian civilian population to reject Mussolini and Hitler and live for Italy and civilization. As an incentive, American bombers raided the city, destroying its railways. Panic broke out among the Romans. Convinced by Mussolini that the Allies would never bomb the Holy City, civilians poured into the Italian capital for safety. The bombing did more than shake their security in the city. It shook their confidence in their leader. The denizens of Rome were not alone in such disillusion. In a meeting in northern Italy, Hitler attempted to revive the flagging spirits of Il Duce, as well as point out his deficiencies as a leader. Afraid that Mussolini, having suffered successive military setbacks, would sue for a separate peace, leaving the Germans alone to battle it out with Allied forces along the Italian peninsula, Hitler decided to meet with his one-time role model to lecture him on the manly art of war. Mussolini remained uncharacteristically silent during the harangue, partly due to his own poor German — he would request a translated synopsis of the meeting later — partly due to his fear of Hitler's response should he tell the truth, that Italy was beaten and could not continue to fight. Mussolini kept up the charade for his German allies. Italy would press on. But no one believed the brave front anymore. Just a day later, Hitler secretly ordered Field Marshal Erwin Rommel to take command of the occupied Greek islands, better to pounce on Italy if and when Mussolini capitulated to the U.S. But within a week, events would take a stunning turn.
And on 18 July 1955, following a visit from Ho Chi Minh and his ministers, the Soviet Union announced it would grant Hanoi 400 million rubles, about 100 million bucks, in economic aid. On July 7th, China had announced that Beijing would extend Hanoi economic aid of about 800 million yuan, about 200 million bucks. The July grants from China and the Soviet Union enabled Hanoi to initiate an ambitious industrialization program. In less than 10 years, the North was producing items not yet made in the South. Continued aid from Hanoi's fellow communist nations, which sustained North Vietnam in its war against South Vietnamese and their American allies until 1975, when they defeated the South Vietnamese forces and reunified their country. And that's military history for today. Now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Front Lines of Freedom want our listeners to get trained and get armed in that order. We fully support the right to keep and bear arms for all law-abiding families, and we encourage you to find out about the laws governing use of deadly force in your state and follow them to the letter. And of course, don't forget to follow the rules of safety and common sense whenever you're carrying a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, a 55-year-old man previously convicted of stalking was reportedly shot by his intended victim when he came to kill her. Horace Johnson was indicted in April for stalking a 41-year-old woman and trying to burn down her house. But apparently, he's not one to move on and let go of the past. About 10 o'clock on the evening, he called the woman and announced his intention to kill her. When Johnson arrived at the victim's house, he hollered for her to come outside. She emerged from her home and answered with two blasts from her shotgun. At least one pellet grazed his neck. After being shot, Johnson left the residence, drove a short distance away, and called 911. While he was being treated at a local hospital, police investigating the incident learned of the past conflict between the two. Johnson was arrested and charged with third-degree domestic violence and harassment. No charges were brought against the female victim for shooting the stalker.
Thanks, Colonel. Just so we're all on the same page, according to the Psychiatric Times, here's the definition of stalking. Stalking is defined as repeated and persistent unwanted communications and/or approaches that produce fear in the victim. And just so we all know how serious a problem this is, I did some research on stalkers, and here's what I found out. According to the Bureau of Justice, in 2021, about 3.4 million of all persons aged 16 or older were victims of stalking. Only 29% of all stalking victims reported the problem to the police. Females are stalked more than twice as often as males. An estimated 67% of victims were fearful of being killed or physically harmed. 67% of stalking victims knew their stalker. Victims were more likely to be stalked by an intimate partner. Only about 16% of all stalking victims sought victim services. and 24% of victims said the stalking behaviors lasted 2 years or longer. Well, here are some things you can do to lessen the chance you'll be stalked. First, be very careful about who you let into your life. 80% of all murder victims knew their attacker, and 67% of all stalking victims knew their stalker. Here's the bottom line. People who do this aren't psychologically all there. Here's a rule that I live by. When you let crazy people into your life gets crazy. So be very careful who you date, who you let into your home, and who you socialize with. Second, vary your routine. Don't let yourself be patterned in your day-to-day lives. Take a different route into work every once in a while, and don't always leave at the same time every day. Mix it up, and you'll be safer. Third, if you think you're being stalked, then by all means, contact the police. They may not be able to do anything at first, but at least get the problem documented. It always helps if there is a paper trail. If appropriate, get some type of personal protection or restraining order put in place. And fourth, restraining orders are made of paper and won't stop bullets. So get good firearms training and carry your gun whenever you can. It's also a good idea to get some open-handed skills and carry a less than lethal weapon like pepper spray or gel. Now, this woman did a great job, but there are a few things she could have done better. First, she should have called the police right away. It is possible that they could have picked him up en route to her house, and then she wouldn't have had to live with the trauma of shooting a man. Second, instead of going out on the porch, she should have stayed inside the safety of her home, thereby allowing her to get armed and set up a defensive position behind cover. And third, make the criminal create noise and signs of forcible entry. This helps you out should the matter end up in court. Remember, you have stronger legal protection when you're inside your home. It's called Castle Doctrine. Despite that, this Alabama woman did a great job. She survived her attack, and Front Lines of Freedom salutes her.
Our movie of the month is Our Kind of Love. You can go to the Front Lines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can watch it for free. We'll review it at the end of the month, and I'd appreciate getting your comments about it. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Front Lines of Freedom, Chaplain Jonathan Dobbs will discuss COVID in our military. Co-host Skip Coriel will introduce his latest book. We'll talk with National Guard Brigadier General Gary Roper, and we'll discuss the Battle of the Month with General Chris Petty. Our book, Front Lines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and get our nation returned to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. You can purchase this book on frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Front Lines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the Front Lines of Freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you won't get anywhere else on the Front Lines of Freedom. Dismissed.